Good morning. I was on the ride home from Jamal a couple weeks ago, and we were talking about how much we couldn't wait to come back, and I didn't expect it to be in 2 weeks. But it is really nice to be here. We were talking as well, and I just want to let y'all know beforehand that I visited a few congregations, and I mean, I haven't preached at a ton, but the welcome that y'all gave us was just incredible. The hospitality, everyone came up and talked to us and introduced themselves and was very, very sincere. And I want to thank just how much we felt at home and how, I mean, we were just blown away talking about on the way home. It's like we felt like we had known, I had never met anyone here, and we felt like we had known y'all for a long time. And I know some of y'all know the Carswells, but I don't think he knew many people here. But anyway, it was just, we really appreciate it, and y'all are just really, really kind and thoughtful to us, and we really felt at home. This morning, if you want to turn to Habakkuk in the Old Testament, it's one of the minor prophets. Before we get started, there's not much you can tell about Habakkuk. Habakkuk is one of those books that we just don't know much about. Habakkuk is only mentioned twice, and both times his name is mentioned in Habakkuk, in chapter 1 and then chapter 3. There's not much we really can know about. We don't really know much about when it was written. We kind of, if you go research and if you look around, what was going on when he's talking, it's obviously before the Babylonians took power, so it's going to be before 586. But it's kind of, in general, maybe at the time that Jeremiah was talking, and that would have been about 610. So obviously, when you read Habakkuk, it's after Israel has been taken captive, but it's been probably somewhere in the 600s, probably closer to the Babylonian. So 610 sounds to be a good number, though it's not perfect. Other than that, there's not much to be written about Habakkuk. We don't know who he was. It's not like Jeremiah or Isaiah. We don't know what his profession was. We just don't know much about it. But Habakkuk, to me, is, we're going to talk about this morning, is the biggest example of patience, to me, at least, in the Old Testament. And we'll look at a few reasons why. It also has the funniest moment in the Bible, and we'll talk about that in a moment, more cynical, maybe, than funny, just here in the first chapter. But we'll go ahead and get started. Just as I said, some context. Israel basically has been taken captive. Judah is surrounded by Assyria, and this is the time period of the gospel of basically Judah alone, and they have not repented. Judah has been told repeatedly by Jeremiah, by the other prophets, repent, and it's kind of gotten to where it's too late that their punishment is inevitable. But in Habakkuk chapter 1, verse 1, says, "The burden which the prophet Habakkuk saw, O Lord, how long shall I cry, and you will not hear? Even cry out to you, say violence, and you will not save. Why do you show me iniquity, and cause me to see trouble? For plundering and violence are before me, there is strife, and contention arises. Therefore the law is powerless, and the justice never goes forth. The wicked surround the righteous, therefore perverse judgment proceeds." Obviously, it's bad. And the sad part about this, I had actually had the wrong assumption for a long time that he's talking about the Assyrians. Because I said they're surrounded by Assyria, and you would think that they're always having pressure. Assyria didn't want to leave them there. Assyria always wanted to conquer Judah, but God allowed them to be on their own. He allowed them to not be conquered. And for a long time, I had thought, oh, well, they're surrounded by Assyria. All his enemies surround me. That kind of makes sense, right? But when you look at the context of what he's talking about, and then we'll look at them later on in chapters, he's talking about his own countrymen. These are men who are supposed to know God's word, and yet look at the way he describes it. He says in mid-verse 3, "Plundering and violence arises before me, strife and contention, the law is powerless, and justice never goes forth, and the wicked surround the righteous." This is a bad time, and it's among God's people, the people who knew better. And I'm going to look for a moment. This is what is kind of funny to me, and it's more cynical because it's kind of a dark humor that God has, and I find it very curious. This is God's answer starting in verse 5. "Look among the nations and watch. Be utterly astounded, for I will work a work in your days which you would not believe, though I were to told you. For indeed I am raising up the Chaldeans, a bitter and hasty nation, which marches through the breadth of the earth to possess dwellings that are not theirs. They are terrible and dreadful. Their judgment and their dignity proceed from themselves. Their horses are swifter than leopards and more fierce than evening wolves. Their chargers charge ahead. Their cavalry comes from afar. They fly as the eagle that hastens to eat. They all come for violence. Their faces are set like the east wind. They gather captives like sand. They scoff at kings, and princes are scorned by them. They deride every stronghold, for they heap up earthen mounds and seize it. Then his mind changes and he transgresses. He commits offense, ascribing to the power of his God. Let's put this in, obviously, the way this is written is a lot of the prophets. There's a lot of similes, a lot of metaphors, a lot of things are repeated. But let's put it in a little bit more terms that we can understand. Hosea calls out and he says, God, there is so much pain. There's so much violence. There's so much sin going on. When are you going to do something about it? And God says, you think it's bad now. You wait. You don't even understand what's about to happen. You have no idea what kind of judgment I'm about to bring down. You think you've got it bad now? Just wait. These people are way, way worse. Now consider this for a moment. Habakkuk is crying out to God. This is a prayer, as a matter of fact. This is a prayer and it's an answer. It goes back and forth. We'll see a couple times in later chapters. But basically, Habakkuk goes to God and he prays, God, please deliver us. And God says, no. It's about to get much worse. You have no idea. What's Habakkuk supposed to do with that? What's he supposed to understand about this? God says, no, it's going to get worse. And Habakkuk, we'll see his answer begins in verse 12. He says, are you not from everlasting, O Lord my God, my Holy One? We shall not die, O Lord, for you have appointed them for judgment. O rock, you have marked them for correction. You are of pure eyes to behold an evil and cannot look on wickedness. Now, if we stopped right here, it would seem that Habakkuk got a satisfactory answer. It would seem that he got what he wanted because he says, you know, are you not everlasting? We're not going to die. And when he kind of means here, and he says in the next part, that basically you have promised us. You have just promised us, the promise of the Messiah comes later on, that you are going to preserve our lineage. He says, okay, so it seems like he's saying, okay, so you're going to send these nations, but it's okay. I know we'll be okay. You know, we're not going to die. But he doesn't stop there because in the second part of verse 13, he says, why do you look on those who deal treacherously and hold your tongue when the wicked devours a person more righteous than he? Why do you make men like fish of the sea, like creeping things that have no ruler over them? They catch up all of them with a hook. They catch them in their net and gather them in their dragnet. Therefore they rejoice and are glad. Therefore they sacrifice to their net and they burn incense to their dragnet because their share is sumptuous and their food is plentiful. Shall they therefore enter their net and continue to slay the nations without pity? He says, you haven't answered my question yet, God. You have not answered how you're going to stop this. These people are so bad that they, in the first part of 14, he says, you've made them to where they don't care about anyone. They're man, or they're not even men anymore. They're beasts. They creep over and just take over things. Have you ever seen like ants or other kind of animals just swarm something and just control it? I mean, you watch a bunch of ants take over a grasshopper or something. It starts with one, and then suddenly the entire ant bed seems like it's out there. And so these people just swarm over, and they just take whatever they want. And then in the second part, in verse 16, in 15 and 16, he's saying they just go in there with a hook. They go in with a net, they just drag out. They drag the net through the river, and they just gather it all up. Nothing stops them. And the worst part about it is, he says in the second part of it, of verse 16, is that they sacrifice to their net. This net, I believe, is to be their strength, their power. Look at the Babylonians. They didn't look to God for guidance. They had power. They had military strength. And that's what drove them on. And that's what they believed in. They didn't believe in God. They believed in their own might. He's saying, you're letting people like that run over us. He says, why would you do that? And in verse 1 of chapter 2, he says, I will stand my watch and set myself on the rampart and see what he will say to me and what I will answer when I am corrected. There's a couple things that I want to mention about Habakkuk here. And the first part is, this is something I've been studying, I think, harder than I've ever studied, is the fact of questioning God. And it really seems to be taboo because I never heard of it where the church that I come from. Nobody really ever, we didn't really talk about it that much. But there is, however, seems to be the case here in Habakkuk that he questions God. And God doesn't punish him for it. And I know there's a difference between questioning God and blaming God and just letting that idea carry forth and dwelling on that. But he is seriously questioning his faith in God. and he's asking God if he can, if God will deliver. And the second part about that is, he doesn't have an arrogant attitude about it. You know, we have some people that, God, if you don't do this, I won't believe in you. That's not the kind of testing, and that's not the kind of faith that we're talking about. Consider last time I was here, I talked about Gideon. Now, Gideon, he wanted to test, not to test God, but he wanted his faith proved when he had the fleece, and he, you know, God gave him what he wanted, and he did it again. So this idea of, you know, having your faith tested goes beyond just, you know, somebody come up to me and asking what I believe in. It goes in our personal beliefs and how much do we trust God and how much do we believe that He is able. But in verse 1 of chapter 2, he says, I'm going to wait. He says, I will be patient in this. He says, I want this answer, but I will wait and see what you will say. And then the last part I think is really neat, and it really shows the character of Habakkuk. It says, and what I will answer when I am corrected. That shows a lot of humility, that Habakkuk is ready to be corrected, and he understands that God probably knows more than he does, and that God's going to give him a better answer than he can create for himself. Now, we're not going to read all of chapter 2, mainly the first part. There's going to be some woes later on that we won't want to talk about. But Habakkuk has first questioned God in the first chapter, and he says, look, there's all this pain around me. What are you going to do? And God says, well, I'm going to make it worse. And Habakkuk says, well, you know, there's all these people who don't serve you. There's all these people who are just believing in themselves, and they're sinning, and you're not doing anything about it. But he says, I'll wait for the answer. And here's God's answer in verse 2 of chapter 2. It says, then the Lord answered to me and said, write the vision and make it plain on tablets, that he may run who reads it. For the vision is yet for an appointed time, but at the end it will speak, and it will not lie. Though it tarries, wait for it, because it will surely come, it will not tarry. Behold the proud, his soul is not upright in him, but the just shall live by faith. Indeed, because he transgresses by wine, he is a proud man. He does not stay at home because he enlarges his desire as hell, and he is like death, and cannot be satisfied. He gathers himself up all nations, and heaps for himself all peoples. Will not these take up a proverb against him, and a taunting riddle against him, and say, woe to him who increases, and what is not his, how long? And to him who loads himself with many pledges, will your creditors not rise up suddenly, with an irate waken who oppresses you? And you will become their booty, because you have plundered many nations, and all the remnant of the people shall plunder you. Because of men's blood, and all the violence of the land and the city, and all that dwell in it. Now, I'm not going to read the rest of this, because there's a lot of woes towards those who commit evil, but the first one, I think, is enough to make our point. But looking back, the first part of God's answer starts in verse 2. He says, I'm going to give you a vision. And it's unclear about this vision. I personally believe the vision is in chapter 3, but I can't say that for certain. Just a lot of the images that Habakkuk gives seems to be like he's writing down a song from a vision, but it's not certain. Either way, God is giving him a vision of the future of Babylon. And he says, make it, verse 2, write the vision, make it plain, that he who reads it may run, who weak reads it. For the vision is yet for an appointed time, but at the end of it, it will speak, and it will not lie. He says, I'm going to give you a vision. You need to write it down. It will give faith to those who read it. Those who understand it can know that things are going to get better. And he says, it's not happened yet in verse 3, but it's going to. And then the second part of that is the most important, I think. Though it tarries, wait for it, because it will surely come, it will not tarry. Though you think it's going to take a long time, Habakkuk, it's going to happen. You don't have to wait too long for it, and you don't have to worry if I'm going to go through with it. Verse 4, we know it's quoted quite a bit when it says, behold the proud, his soul is not upright in him, but the just shall live by faith. This is something he has given Habakkuk, a lesson he's teaching him, that yes, there is pain, there is problems, but he says, I'm going to deliver you. And the curious thing, and the thing I think that's hard for us to understand, is the few verses before that when he says, it will not tarry, you have to wait for it. What's that commercial that we have? It's my money and I want it now. J.P. Whitworth or whatever. And then that's everybody's attitude. Well, this is mine and I need it right now. Well, that's mine and I want that. That's my money. That's my job. That should be my job. That's That's exactly what God is talking about here. You have to be patient when you ask God for deliverance from God. Now, starting in verse 5, it's talking about that sinful man. And just to summarize the little that we read, that basically you have a man who gathers up what's not his, who reaps the souls of men, the blood of men, and he says it's going to come back on you. You can't just go throughout killing people, and you can't go sowing your wild oats and not have it come back on you. Because in verse 7, we are creditors of not, will not your creditors rise up suddenly? Will they not awaken who oppress you, and you become their booty? And then in chapter 3, that kind of goes on, the idea that the Chaldeans are going to sin. They're going to be, they've already been doing evil in the world. They've already been conquering, and they're really about to get into it. But, they're going to pay for it. He says, I know that they're going to do some terrible things, but they're going to receive their just reward. And also the people in Judah at the time. In chapter 3, like I said, I feel like it's kind of, this could be the vision. I don't want to say for certain because it's hard to say. But you have things like in verse 3, God came from Teman, the Holy One from Mount Paran. His glory covered the heavens and all the earth was full of his praise. Verse 6, he stood and measured the earth. He looked and startled the nations. And the everlasting mountains were scattered. Their perpetual hills bowed. His ways are everlasting. And then you go down to 10, the mountains saw you and trembled. The overflowing of the water passed by. The deep uttered its voice and lifted its hands on high. And then in verse 13, you went forth the salvation of your people for salvation with your anointed. You struck the head of the house of the wicked by laying bare the foundations of the neck. And I just skip down because it's a lot of metaphors of God coming out and punishing these nations and doing what he said that he would do. Now, in verse 16, it's kind of a song, as I said, and possibly the vision. It's not really important. I mean, we know that if it's not the vision, it's God's judgment either way. But that ends in verse 15. And in verse 16, we have, this is God, his initial reaction when God said he was going to bring the Babylonians. Verse 16 says, when I heard, my body trembled, my lips quivered at the voice. Rottenness entered my bones, and I trembled in myself, that I might rest in the day of trouble. When he comes up to the people, he will invade them with his troops. So the fig trees may not blossom, nor fruit be on the vines, so the labor of the olive may fail, and the fields yield no fruit. So the flock may be cut off from the fold, and there may be no herd in the stalls, yet I will rejoice in the Lord. I will joy in the God of my salvation. The Lord is my strength. He will make my feet like deer's feet, and he will make me walk on my high hills. No matter, when you read verse 16, I don't know if I've ever seen somebody that afraid. Rottenness entered his bones, his knees were shaking, his body trembled, his lips were quivering. I mean, you have somebody who is just absolutely frightened. I don't even think that's a good word for it. I can't find a word for the way he's describing how he felt. He said he trembled inside of himself. I mean, I suppose I've had that feeling sometimes where you can feel your insides almost trembling. You're so scared, you're so nervous. But the feeling that he has, he says, I can't describe it. This is how bad it is. But he says in verse 17, no matter how bad it gets, no matter it seems like I'm going to starve, no matter it seems like everything I have has been taken away, he says in verse 18, I will rejoice in the Lord, and I will joy in the God of my salvation. The Lord God is my strength. He'll make my feet like the deer's feet, and he'll make me walk on my high hills. Not only am I going to survive, but I'm going to be prancing around like a deer on a hill. I am going to be high as a mountain, and I am going to be extremely happy in God. Now, this sounds almost like a fairy tale, doesn't it? Because we know how the real world works. We know how much pain and sorrow can cause, and how much pain we can have just from, maybe things going bad, maybe tragedy can strike. I wanted to share something real quick, and I hate... There's probably the two most emotional stories I've ever told. The one I told last time I was here, and that kind of shook me up. It got me flustered, and it was... I don't want to make... Brian Gibson, in the bulletin that y'all received, he has a good article there on emotionalism. I thought it was well-fitting, because I wanted to say something before I told you this story this morning. And then Brian Gibson, then we have that article by him about emotion versus truth. And I just don't, before we, I will be going to other places, but I don't mean to shake you with emotion. I mean to shake you by maybe you can relate to it. I had a brother named Todd Law when I lived at home with my parents, that he was like a father to me. I mean, he was the closest thing I will ever say that was to a father that besides my own father. As a matter of fact, him and his wife, my parents would have made them my parents, or they would have wanted them to take us, me and my brother, in had something happened to my parents. And he was just such a gentleman and such a knowledgeable, I mean, he was such a godly man. He was about 5 years younger than my father, about my mother's age, and they just started adopting some children, started fostering. They were getting into the adoption process when it was discovered he had a brain tumor. I was about 12 years old at this time, so I mean, I kind of knew it was serious, but I didn't know how bad it was. And they removed him the size of a grapefruit, and the procedure went fine, but over the next few years, he had seizures every day. And it was just terrible to watch him go through this. I mean, I had never seen somebody have a seizure before him, and it's the most helpless feeling in the world to see somebody going through it. And the doctors had told us before, and told them that, hey, you know, if you can last 5 years, usually brain tumors don't come back if you last for 5 years. And he got to the end of his fifth year and it came back. And he never got better. And he would have seizures. I mean, it was just to watch him go through that. And I remember I saw him a couple weeks before he died. I had went home to visit him. My parents, and I went to go see him. And he was just, he couldn't even do anything. I mean, they had to feed him. He couldn't talk. And I was upset, and I didn't realize he was so close to the end of his life. And when he passed away, my mom called me, and I'm not a crying man. I could count how many times before that I had cried since I had reached probably about 15, and I broke down. It was in October of 2009, and I felt like a wreck, because I just thought his children, the two children, his wife that he's leaving, you know, he went through this for 7 years. And, I mean, I'm talking about prayers from all of, he had over hundreds of prayers every day, I guarantee, prayed for him. I mean, every church that we knew about him, that we had connections with, and it was just like everyone had to have been praying for him every single day. And he never got better. And that's what it was always prayed for, right? You know, I pray that, you know, that you'll restore his health if it's your will. And a lot of times we seem to forget about that if it's your will part, don't we? And I didn't understand. For 2 weeks, I didn't understand. And I was like Habakkuk. I questioned God every single day. And I thought, how would you allow this man who had done so much good for you, so much good for me, so much good for his children, so much good for everyone that he knew, how would you take him out of his life before he's even 50? Before he's even 45, you would take him out of his life. Actually, I think he's 45 when he passed away. But I didn't understand. And it took about 2 weeks before I stopped asking the question why and asking the question what. What do you have planned now? What are you going to do now that he's gone? What are you going to do now that you didn't answer everyone's prayers? And I began to realize that with his example, I can never complain about my life, ever. I mean, the stuff that he went through was just, out of 7 years, I would ask him every day, how you feeling, Todd? How you feeling, Todd? Every day it's either better than I deserve or I couldn't ask for better. And the attitude that he had was amazing. Only one day in 7 years he said, I'm not doing that well. And I guarantee you, folks, he looked awful. I can't imagine the day he had that day. But I can carry that on for the rest of my life. I can tell his children the example that he had. I can tell you the example that he had for me and for everyone, a single person that he met. When I was 15, I had to drive him around. He was still co-owner for a construction company, and he ran the business part of it. And I drove him around everywhere, and we couldn't get out of the car without having a discussion about the Bible, without him challenging me and my faith. And I just thought, I will carry that to the day I die. And everyone that met him will carry that to the day they die. God doesn't answer prayers the way that we want him to always. And I may not always fully understand. I feel like he could have done more good in this world. But we don't always know God's plan, and we don't always know God's will. In Romans chapter 8, we're going to go to New Testament. As I said, the Old Testament sometimes seems to be kind of hard. We read about David, and we read Solomon and Proverbs, and it seems like just things change in an instant. And you think, how does things go from being terrible to good? We see David, you know, times he's like, well, you know, my enemies are pressed all around me, but I'm going to glorify in God. And you think, that's not realistic. We can't do that. You know, that's not how the world works. You have to grieve. You have to sorrow. Romans chapter 8, starting in verse 23 says, not only that, but we also who have the first fruits of the Spirit, even we ourselves groan within ourselves, eagerly waiting for the adoption, the redemption of our body. For we were saved in this hope, but hope that is seen is not hope. For why does one still hope for what he sees? But if we hope for what we do not see, we eagerly wait for it with perseverance. Likewise, the Spirit also helps in our weakness. For we do not know what we should pray as we ought, but the Spirit Himself makes intercession for us with groanings which cannot be uttered. Now he who searches the heart knows what is the mind of the Spirit is, because he makes intercession for the saints according to the will of God. And we know that all things work together for good to those who love God, to those who are called according to His purpose. When you read that, the doubt just sometimes, I know not always, but it can seem to melt away. Because we don't understand this world. It's one of the hardest things that I've struggled with over the years, and I don't know if I'll ever stop, is knowing, you know, that question. And everyone seems to bring up this question. It's the first one that people bring up against Christianity. Well, if God is real, why is all this pain in the world? Why do all these bad things happen? And God says here that we don't know what's going on. In verse 26, the Lord, the Spirit helps us with our weaknesses. We don't know what we should pray for, he says, but the Spirit makes intercession for us. The Spirit helps us along. God helps us along. God helps us know what we need. Verse 27, for he searches the heart, knows what the mind of the Spirit is, because he makes intercession for the saints according to the will of God. And in the next verse, now we know that all things work together for good. You know, no matter what we think is best for us, no matter what we think we need, God knows best. And that's a hard lesson to learn sometimes. Because when we pray for something, usually, and that's the hard thing to know about prayer, is we think an answered prayer is only one that God answers how we want it to be answered, don't we? If we pray for someone's health, or we pray for somebody to receive some blessing, we think that God only answers when he does that. But that's not how prayer works, because God is looking out for us. In verse 28, I know that I've had some, it seems like sometimes when one thing can go wrong, everything will go wrong. I know that it's kind of how it is financially. You know, if I run late on, if I get a new bill out of nowhere, I'm going to have 20 more. My tire is going to go flat. I'm going to have to get my transmission fixed. Something's going to happen, and I'm going to be laying down in the dirt thinking, how am I going to fix this? But verse 28 says, and we know that all things work together for good to those who love God, to those who are called according to his purpose. That's a lot of hope. That's a lot of praise. And that's a lot of thanksgiving that we can give to God to know that it's all going to work out. But notice the last part of that. It says to those who are called according to his purpose. There is a stigma, and there is a reason that God gives us good things, and that God blesses us. Let's turn to Galatians chapter 6, the passage that Brother Josh read for us earlier. Galatians chapter 6. We have, we do know that God, he rains down on the just and on the unjust. And there's a lot of times we think that, why, God? I mean, think about the politics. You know, look at the people who get in office. These are people who lie and cheat to get there. And we think, how did they make it? You know, we see the people who get up higher in the company by lying and cheating. We think, how did they get there? Why? That's the position that I deserve. That's something that I need. And we see all the time people that are just doing evil and evil and evil, and all they get is good, good, good. They're getting money. They're getting blessings. They're getting friends. They're getting happiness. And then here we are, trying to help other people out, trying to do good, and we're just getting shot in the foot for it. But we learned something here new in Galatians. Galatians chapter 6, verse 6. It says, let him who is taught the word share in all things, in all good things with him who teaches. Do not be deceived. God is not mocked. For whatever man sows, that will he also reap. For he who sows his flesh will of the flesh reap corruption, but he who sows the Spirit will of the Spirit reap everlasting life. And let us not grow weary in doing and while doing good, for in due season we shall reap if we do not lose heart. Therefore, as we have opportunity, let us do good to all, especially those who are of the household of faith. Now, I can't help but think of the situation when I read this. I had a friend in high school that I don't consider her a friend anymore. I mean, she was a really close friend, and she kind of went out the deep end when she went to college, as a lot of people do. And she's an absolute partier now. And I had to remove her from my Facebook after one quote. Somebody posted a picture on her wall that said, they had a picture of Jesus, like with a crown of thorns, blood going out, a portrayal of Jesus. And it said, if we don't sin, then God died for nothing. Ha ha, can't wait to party this weekend. And I thought, wow, that is incredible. You are that confident in your ability to sin and not have anything come back on you. You are that confident to spit in God's face and say, huh, you died, so I'm going to go do what I want. I don't owe you nothing. Needless to say, we're not friends anymore. And I was very unappreciative. Which, as I said, somebody else posted on her wall, and she had a good laugh about it. And I said, well, we're done. You know, this is absolutely hopeless if you're going to spit in God's blood. But in verse 7, it says, God is not mocked, for whatever a man reaps, sows that will he also reap. For he who sows his flesh will of the flesh reap corruption. But who sows of the Spirit will of the Spirit reap everlasting life. Now, I know that a lot of times it seems like we get the short end of the stick. And I know a lot of times it seems like that other people do so much well when they're doing so much sin. But God says that, hey, those who reap according to the flesh are going to, that sow to the flesh are going to reap according to the flesh. And you know what that means? That means he's right. That means he's going to fulfill his promises. And those who sow according to the Spirit are going to reap according to the Spirit. We prove that with Habakkuk, that what God says he's going to do, he's going to do. And then in verse 9, and let's not grow weary and while doing good, for in due season we shall reap if we do not lose heart. Now, this is one of the most complicated. This is the deepest verse, I think, that we've read all night. I mean, all morning, I'm sorry. And I think I want to close on this verse. Because the first part of it is, let us not grow weary while doing good. Paul understands something very quickly, that doing good is not always fun. And doing good is not always the best route for us when it comes to us physically, emotionally. It's painful sometimes to do God's Word. And it's painful to serve Him, and sometimes it wears and tears on us. You know, for example, if we're trying to help someone out that don't want to be helped, that's emotionally a strain. To do something for somebody that doesn't appreciate it, do something for somebody that's not going to take it back, doing good is not easy. It's the hardest thing in the world sometimes to do good, because sometimes you will say, forget it. I'll just do my own thing. But there are times when it is weary. But in the last part, for in due season we shall reap if we do not lose heart. Two parts to this. The first part is, we're going to reap the good that we sow. And we're going to have it back. But it's not going to be when we want it always. He says in due season. When it's time to happen, God will bless us. When it's time for things to come to fruition, God will allow it. And the last part is that we don't lose heart. Consider just for a moment, thinking about this due season. I thought about this a lot, about Jesus Christ. You know, think about if Jesus Christ would have came in the days of the kings. They would have been saved from slavery, I feel like. Possibly. I mean, I'll say that. And then 38 years after God, Jesus was here, Jerusalem was destroyed. So I can't really say that. But that would have been a good time for him to be there. I mean, you think about the 500 years or so after the kings that Israel they struggled immensely. The priesthood was divided. Even when they came back during the years of silence, the priesthood never became what it should have been. It was always bought out, or it was always, the priesthood was never real. I mean, when Israel had been taken captive, they sent back priests because the people there weren't serving God right, and the priests they sent back didn't even know what they were doing. And that just, there was never a real priesthood until Christ came and became the true priesthood. And you say, how much better would it have been if God would have been there, you know? If Jesus would have came then, you know, he could have maybe helped them out and gave them the real priesthood. And, you know, then there would have been the 500 years of silence. And then you think about in due season. During the Roman time, now there's roads. Now there's ample opportunity for the word to spread out. And you think about during the persecution that they had, that allowed them to spread. The travel had gotten much better. The people were beginning to understand that the Pharisees and Sadducees weren't correctly serving God. I mean, it just all came to fruition that Jesus came at the perfect time. And I say all that to say that we don't always get what we need when we think we want it. But God is going to provide if we don't lose heart. But just make no mistake that in verse 8, that he who sows according to the Spirit will reap according to the Spirit. Maybe this has given us a little bit of hope this morning. I know this teaches me a lot of patience because I'm not really a patient person. When I want something done, I want to go ahead and do it. When something needs to be done, I want to go ahead and do it. When I need something, I want it now. That's the typical attitude that I have, that most people have in this world. It's a fast-paced world. But we have to understand that patience is a virtue, and that sometimes things aren't always going to work out the way that we think they are. You know, I feel like I've been blessed in my life, and that's the only our friend that passed away was the only real tragedy that I felt in my life, and I can feel blessed for that. But at the same time, that the patience that I ended up having from that has helped me on later in life. And I know it's hard to turn tragedy or turn sorrow, and I'm just talking about in day-to-day life, tragedy, sorrow, anger. But we have to realize that when we're doing well, when we're doing good, that God will serve us. And that in Habakkuk, and I think it's crazy, and you may think it's not crazy, but I find it to be crazy that he says at the end of the verse there, at the end of verse 17 there, that I will be like a deer. I will be up on my high places, that I will serve God, and I will give him praise no matter what. Maybe we can have that same attitude. Maybe we can have that same joy to serve God, because knowing that God's going to pay us back and that God's going to give us our just rewards is something that we all have to look forward to, and that we can all serve God without getting disheartened and serve God without getting too frustrated, too upset. If there's anyone here this morning who needs to put God first in their life, as I've said before, it's not the easiest thing to do. It's a lifetime commitment. But when I consider God and what he did for us, you go to Philippians chapter 2, and he says he considered it not robbery to be equal with God. Another way you can say that, he did not desire to be equal with God. He was willing to come down as a man to serve God, to serve God and to die for us. He was willing to give the ultimate sacrifice. And it just takes, we don't have to do that. We don't really have to give up heaven. We're going to receive heaven if we serve him. But it takes the sacrifice that God made. And I tell you what, if somebody was to die for me, I would be loyal to them for the rest of my life. You know, if somebody was to lay down their life for me today or tomorrow or any time, I would always have a special place in my heart. We've got to think about it. Jesus did that for us. And the least we can do is serve him and give him give him what he has given us. If there's anyone here who needs to put Christ first in their life, you can come to the front while together we stand. Come on.